Geography. Free space for geography. Extending teaching and learning methods beyond the boundaries of campus.
Did you hear about Frontline?
Frontline,
by the way, has an outstanding production.
Geography Frontline.
Hey frontliners, how's it going? Welcome to the show, to episode 125 of Geography Frontline. Hey, whoa, it took me quite some while till the release of this episode. You know, as you know, and may have followed on Facebook, I tried to produce the show on Monday, but then I completely forgot to bring my MacBook back home to produce and record the show. So all the preps were just sitting at my office, and that was kind of not the best thing. And so a day later, I was planning to record the show on Tuesday, and then my little son, my toddler, he's almost 2 years old, running around. It was in the best mood ever and wanted to do running and playing around and was eating like, I don't know. He just wasn't sleepy, and then I put him to bed finally at around 10 o'clock or so. And so that was far too late to start recording the show, of course. But well, now, next day, I finally made it. And so episode 125 is going to be recorded on a Wednesday. I think I've never recorded a show on Wednesday. But anyways, so last week we talked about asparagus, right? And this week we have quite a bit follow-ups on that topic, and we got something new, and we even got a new section for the show. Topics for today are asparagus, society, and jobs. And so, as I said last week, we talked about asparagus. Let's do this follow-up on the topic, because we had a quick vote about it. And there is some additional feedback I would like to talk about. So, the question was, Poland's EU membership destroys asparagus industry. That was the question of the quick vote last week. And and why did I ask that? Because Polish workers are usually the ones picking asparagus in Germany and in countries like the Netherlands. And they're very low paid, not very well paid. And so with joining the European Union, the situation has changed quite a bit in terms of the labor market and prices. So here are the results of last week's quick vote. Poland's EU membership destroys asparagus industry. Answer A. No way, just get other workers. Nobody voted for answer A. Could be. You need skilled workers. Answer B. I was voted for by just 33%. Wow. And of course, prices will explode. Also, nobody who decided to vote for answer C. And answer D. Another opinion. The majority, 67%. And as I said, if you should have another opinion, you are free to post a comment on the results page of the quick vote. Geographer did that. And let's hear what he has to say. And I have to say, and by all means, but I'm going to bridge some passages because it's a really, really long comment. Anyways, but very interesting. He starts. But why the asparagus industry? What about apples or potatoes? Yeah, so you get the idea. He loves writing long comments. And where? He asks. I don't think that Poland's EU membership will destroy the Spanish asparagus industry. Furthermore, I doubt that any Polish workers are going to Spain. Neither will it destroy the Polish asparagus industry. So, which asparagus industry are we talking about? Geographer. We are talking about the German asparagus industry and the one in the Netherlands, if you want to refer to this market. So, to make that clear, German asparagus industry in the Netherlands. So let's have a look at Germany, he says. Why do German farmers hire Polish workers? Number one, EU law gives them the right to pay them with home wages. So Polish workers get Polish wages, German workers get German wages, and Polish wages are lower than German wages, so Polish workers are cheaper than German workers. Okay, that's absolutely right. And second, or number two, harvesting asparagus means you have to be quick. If it gets too much light on it, it loses the white color and is downgraded. Which means lower quality, which means lower prices, and it's hard to work for low wages. A few years ago, German farmers had to hire a quota of German workers, and the result? Slower harvesting, higher prices. So, Geographer, what are you saying? That Germans aren't fast enough pickers? You certainly don't relate harvesting skills to passports, right? But let's go on reading. Number three. It's not that easy to cut asparagus properly. You don't have to study for that, but you cannot do it without any knowledge. So here we go. You have to have some knowledge, right? And that is why you can't just go ahead and hire any given person to do the job. You gotta be some kind of experienced. Okay, I get it. And so then he says, if it was that easy, you would have a harvesting machine for it. But for high quality asparagus, you have to do it by hand. So you need workers with some experience, and the Polish workers have it. Cheaper, faster, and higher quality. That's the market economy. Okay. So Poland is an EU member. Polish wages will rise. German farmers will have to pay higher wages, and German asparagus will be more expensive than today. Exactly. That's what I was talking about in the last show. Remember, if the prices go up, there comes a point where people will stop buying asparagus, or where the farmers don't want to pay the higher wages anymore because of their shares being cut by it. Yeah, it's that simple. So what else does he write? He says, let's skip it. So what's the problem? That Poland is an EU member? Yes, because Poland has its own asparagus industry. So it's competing with our German market. And the problem that Polish wages will rise? Yes, but well, of course you could replace Polish workers when they get too expensive. So welcome to the market. As long as you can find customers for German asparagus, you will find German asparagus. And when the markets are satisfied with cheaper asparagus from Poland and or Spain, the German asparagus will vanish. So back to the question, Poland's EU membership destroys asparagus industry. And Geographer says, no, maybe the asparagus industry will move somewhere else, but Poland doesn't destroy it. So yes, so it could destroy, in your opinion, the German asparagus industry, but not the entire asparagus industry of the planet, right? Yeah. So what do you think about that, frontliners? Is Geographer right? Will there always be German asparagus as long as people are willing to buy it? And could it really happen that Germany only imports asparagus from other countries and stops producing asparagus? Think about the example I gave you last episode in the US, right? In the US, asparagus production went down big time because of cheaper imports from Mexico. But what about local products? The need for environmentally green produce. Do you think that societies like the German or the US one, they could move into a direction where you simply would rather stop buying asparagus from other countries because of things like the carbon footprint? That people would say, if it's bad for Mother Earth, then it's bad for us, and we also don't want to pay just any price for produce like asparagus. So let's all move to mushrooms. I personally doubt that. But what about you? Do you really think the markets or the market works like it does no matter what kind of society you have? Perhaps we should really talk about that. While talking about the impact society has on the economy, I stumbled over a paper from Masudur Rahman titled Market State, Civil Society. So Market State, Civil Society Relations and Development in Post-Independent Bangladesh. Some Theoretical Reflections. And there in that journal article, you can read the following. I'm citing from it. The conventional notion of development connotates a process of economic growth brought by industrialization. Various modernization theories and approaches, neoliberal, institutional, etc., regard the problem of capital accumulation as the major constraint of industrialization in developing societies. Of course, Rahman is referring to Bangladesh and developing societies when talking about the issue, but there's one passage that I think is really interesting. In the modernization paradigm, in economic growth model in particular, development is perceived in terms of economic growth, which would be achieved by market forces such as entrepreneurs. So we have the modernization paradigm where development means economic growth. Development is economic growth. Okay. And then he goes on. In the sociological paradigm, as well as the anthropological and historical paradigm, perception of development involves societal changes of a qualitative nature. And that means that development is not only about the economy, but also about social change. So what does this mean for our question about asparagus? Further understanding, Rahman concludes, further understanding of networks shaping economic activities requires a discussion on economy-society relations. Exactly. I think that there's no doubt about it that the economy is shaped, partly shaped by society. Think about socialism, for example, right? But in the existing setting of a globalized world and the installed system of capitalism, could society, and I'm not talking about the world society, but about this society like the German or the US one, could society really make an economic difference? Can society really change the economy today? That's what I would like to know from you. Can society really change the economy today? Answer A. Of course it can, because... Answer B. I'm not sure, because... Answer C. No way, it can't, because... Or answer D. Another opinion. You may have noticed that answers A to C, they all have an open ending. It's not simply yes or no. And so when you participate in this week's quick vote, I want you to do exactly what Geographer did last week. Because that's absolutely amazing and great for the show. Add a comment in the results page of the quick vote. Tell us why, or tell us what you think society can or cannot do, or why it can change the economy today. And that would be absolutely fascinating to read your answers, and amazing to get all these results, so that we can have a vital discussion going on about society and the impact it has on the economy. Yeah, so just go ahead and click on the quick vote button and let us know what you think. Yeah, speaking of social activities becoming more important or being important for our world economy, I found this song. It's from the Ohio-based band HAF. The song cannot be found on iTunes or any platform to buy, at least as far as I could see it. But it's a great one, a great song from the album Narcissist. And this is Social Trend. Great song. This is H A F from the album Narcissist. The song Social Trend. You can't find this anywhere else but the Podsafe Music Network on music.mevio.com. On our way, finding the first winner for the Frontline Sound Riddle T-shirt competition. We got some amazing news. Geographer, the winner of last week's Sound Riddle, wrote me an email saying, "Hey Thorsten, hey, come on, last episode's Sound Riddle? I just sent an email so others can go on to find the or their answer. What if I would tell it on Facebook? No one would continue to listen for it. I think posting the answer on Facebook is destructive." Yeah, that's a really good point, my friend. Of course, you have the option to post your suggestion of the sound riddle on our Facebook wall. But in terms of a little competition where everybody tries to get the right answer, well, I don't know. I just don't want to go ahead and tell you not to post your sound riddle thoughts on Facebook and instead write an email or send in a voicemail. That's also an option, right? But that way, it would be even more interesting, right? To only send an email or voicemail. Nobody knowing what the others might think of the recent sound riddle. Yeah, that makes sense to me. Okay, so, and he goes on and says, "And you got two answers?" Yeah, I got two answers, yours and Judith's. "And both were the correct answers?" Yeah. Yeah, that's right. So, he says no one could read the other's answer before giving the own answer. Really? Yeah, you're right. You wrote the email, so Judith couldn't see your email, and after you already sent in the email, she posted it on Facebook, so it really didn't matter if you read it or not. Okay, yeah, that's right. So then he says, "I think it would be fair if both Judith and me would get the first point." You know what? I guess you're right. So let's call it even. And I award Judith her first point on the road to 5 correct answers to win the free Frontline t-shirt. Hey, that's what I call a great comment, really. That's perfect, I like that. And then he's making a suggestion about how we could handle that and says, I'm taking a look at the incoming time would be necessary for the 5th correct answer. Okay, only for the 5th point, if necessary. But before that, every correct answer should be counted. Okay. I'd say at least for all the emails and the first correct answer on Facebook, that would be okay, right? Because not if you would post the correct answer on Facebook and then everybody jumps in and says, okay, right, I think so too. Everybody would get a point. No. So for all the emails, for all the voicemails, and for the first correct answer on Facebook, from now on, we will count it a point. Okay, so it's 1 for Geographer and 1 for Judith. So far, so good. And then he says, and that's a really funny one. You got me on that one. He says, take a look at episode 115. I knew that sound. Oops. Yeah. Did I really use the same sound riddle twice? How could that happen, huh? I guess I'll have to start making some kind of a list. That's really funny. Okay, we already had it. But anyways, only you and Judith got it right. So what can I say? So let's see what kind of answers we got for last episode's sound riddle. Sounded like this. So Geographer, he suggests the following. It says 124. It's a machine doing a short whatsoever... and then move the thing onwards. Okay, I should recognize the sound, meaning I already know the sound and can recognize it because I know it. So it won't be a knitting machine or postcard sorting machine. So let's say it's a photocopier. And you know what? That is so close. That is so close. A machine that does something with something and then moves the thing onwards. That's right. That's amazing listening skills. Wow. I'm impressed, man. I'm really impressed. But what kind of a thing? Granted, it's kind of hard to know. So I'd say, in case nobody gets it right until next episode, Geographer's answer will count. And he will move up being Frontliner's front runner in the competition to win the free Frontline shirt. And so all the others send in your suggestions and try to grab the point for the right answer for yourselves. What's that sound? And yeah, that's absolutely right. That's the same sound as in episode 124. In 1799, Alexander von Humboldt is on his way to the Americas to observe and write down everything new and important that he senses. As one of the first geographers, he is on an enormous excursion on board the Pizarro. They found a local pilot who is guiding them, the crew, through the region, through the Caribbean where he's currently. And we continue reading in chapter 1-4, first about at Cumana, banks of the Manzanares. On the 16th of July 1799, at break of day, we beheld a verdant coast of picturesque aspect, the mountains of New Andalusia, half veiled by mists, bounded the horizon to the south. The city of Cumana and its castle appeared between groups of cocoa trees. We anchored in the port about 9 in the morning, 41 days after our departure from Corunna. The sick tracked themselves on the deck to enjoy the sight of the land, which was to put an end to their sufferings. Our eyes were fixed on the groups of cocoa trees which border the river, their trunks more than 60 feet high, towered over every object in the landscape. Hmm. That's a nice description, huh? And by the way, did you realize what kind of definition of the word landscape Humboldt uses? Huh? Trunks more than 60 feet high towered over every object in the landscape. I'd call that a very traditional definition. But why wonder at 1799, right? So, that's interesting. A dazzling light was spread through the air, along with whitish hills strewed with cylindric cactuses, and over a sea ever calm, the shores of which were peopled with Alcatraz. That's a brown pelican of the size of a swan. Egrets and flamingos. The splendor of the day, the vivid coloring of the vegetable world, the forms of the plants, the varied plumage of the birds, everything was stamped with the grand character of nature in the equinoctial regions. And here, by the way, we have another great example of Humboldt's empirical method, right? He's not only describing what he sees, but he always tries to set it into context. He tries to call it generalize. He tries to generalize his observations. Yeah. Hmm. That's kind of a very traditional and yeah, pre-scientific way of how to do empirical fieldwork. But it's in fact really the beginning, this seeing, sensing, and describing what you see and trying to set that in and bring that into context, what started the whole thing we call empirical science and in human geography. That's really, really great.
It's a four-letter word. I prepare you for that. Jobs, jobs, and jobs.
Yes, you're right. That's a new jingle. And with me, I love this one so much. Just play it again, right? Hit the button.
It's a four-letter word. I prepare you for that. Jobs, jobs, and jobs.
So what I would like to do now is open a new section of the show that I think might be interesting for you. If somebody asks you a question like this, geography, what can you do with geography? Hmm? What kind of job can you get? Then it's not such a simple answer, right? There are lots of jobs geographers can work in, and it's not like law school where everybody knows where you might end up, right? So on your way finding the right job, you might want to check out different kinds of fields, get experience, and pimp your CV. So that's why we have this new section, jobs. And jobs is all about job offers for internships, part-time jobs, and permanent positions. Every episode, or at least every once in a while, but I hope, really hope every episode, we'll try to present a new job in this section that you can apply for, if you are interested in it, of course. I'm always thinking about how to improve the show, so produce more content that gets you even more interested and that potentially widens our listener base and the frontline community. That's why I'm more than happy to report that this section actually wasn't my idea, but the one of our listeners, Magdalena. She would try to send in new jobs for every episode. And that, isn't that awesome? Huh? Frontliner deciding to become an active producer for the show, creating this, or having this idea for this whole new section about jobs. Hmm? That's absolutely stunning. Thank you so much, Magdalena, for your contribution. But if you, frontliners, should be interested in the section and stumble over something interesting for this section, so please feel free to send in your suggestions. Why not? We can work them in too. Anyways, if you, like me, think that Magdalena's commitment to the show is absolutely wonderful, go ahead and let her know by posting on our Facebook wall or email to comment@geography.com. That's great. So let's start with Magdalena's first post. Hey Frontliners, this is Magdalena. If you're a graduate student looking for an internship, this opportunity might be interesting for you. The Antinea Foundation, a Geneva-based NGO, is looking for an intern for a period of 3 to 6 months who will support the NGO through research making, communications and marine sciences related to their principal project, the Changing Oceans Expedition, which aims at bringing people and the sea closer together through a journey of discovery. The intern should either be enrolled in or have recently completed a graduate level university program. He or she will not be remunerated, but will have the opportunity to experience life on board the expedition. Isn't that great? The deadline for applications is June 1st. You will find more information about the expedition at www.changingoceans.org. So good luck and talk to you soon, Magdalena.
This week's announcements. A little spooky. It's about a first global conference called Monstrous Geographies, Places and Spaces of Monstrosity, taking place July 18th to 20th, 2012, Harris Manchester College in Oxford.
Hey, 1 week earlier, check this out, and the conference wouldn't have ended on Friday the 20th, but Friday the 13th. let's read from the call of papers. What is the relationship between the monstrous and the geographic? Those places monsters inhabit, but also places that are configured as being monstrous in and of themselves. Places that engage notions of self and otherness, inclusion and exclusion, normal and aberrant, defense and contagion. From the necropolis to the killing fields, and from the Amityville horror to the island of Dr. Moreau, geographical locations have acted as the repository or emanation of human evil, made monstrous by the rituals and behaviors enacted within them or by their peculiarities of atmosphere or configuration. Whether actual or imagined, these places of wonder, fear, and horror speak of the symbiotic relation between humanity and location that sees morality, ideology, and emotions given physical form in the house, the forest, the island, the nation, and even faraway worlds in both space and time. These places act as magnets for destructive and evil forces such as the island of Manhattan, and they are the source of malevolent energies and forces such as Transylvania, Area 51, and Ringu. And they are the fulcrum for chaotic warping energies such as the Bermuda Triangle, Atlantis, and Pandemonium. Alongside this, there exists the monstrous geographies created by scientific experimentation, human waste and environmental accidents, creating sites of potential and actual disaster, such as the Chernobyl nuclear plant, the Gulf of Mexico in the wake of the BP oil disaster, and the devastated coastline of Chihuahua, Japan. These places raise diverse post-human quandaries regarding necessities in the present leading to real or imagined futures of humanity and habitation. So that was quite a long bit from the call of papers. But if you should be interested in this first global conference on monstrous geographies, be sure to book your flight to Oxford or your train or whatever. It's taking place July 18th to 20th, and I think it might be worth a trip, really. So, this is it. Episode 125 has come to an end. I hope that you enjoyed listening to the show. love the new job section and send in lots of comments on today's topics. And don't forget the quick vote and the sound riddle. Have a great week, everybody, and never forget, the network is us.